Hello and welcome to Epochs. This is part three of my deep dive into the life and art and achievements of Michelangelo. And I'll just jump straight back in. Last time I finished off by talking about the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. But there's still quite a lot of Michelangelo's life left. Like I say, he lived to be 89. And he worked up almost literally until the last day of his life. He didn't achieve a great deal in the last 10 years or so. But still, there's quite a lot of art left for him to do. So pretty soon after the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel was completed, the Pope, Julius II, died of natural causes. And he was succeeded by Giovanni de' Medici, Pope Leo X. Now, Michelangelo had grown up with him, as I said in part one, Lorenzo the Magnificent, many years before this, had taken Michelangelo under his wing and sort of brought him up in his own household with his son and his nephew. Anyway, so Pope Leo X becomes Pope, and, you know, of course he wants to commission Michelangelo to do work for him. We're told that there was still the ongoing headache that Michelangelo had of building the tomb of Pope Julius II. And Vasari says, for the rest of his life, it was to bring him endless vexations and annoyances and drudgery more than anything else he ever did. I should do a bit less reading this one. I think there was a bit too much last time, but still, a fair bit from Vasari. And that Pope Leo X was no less grandiose in mind and spirit. He was a bit. Although he was more corrupt, Leo X, I'll talk about this next time when I talk all about the actual Medici family in detail, but Pope Leo X was a pretty bad pope. He was the one that brought in indulgences. Indulgences had already existed, they'd existed for hundreds of years, but they were never used on a massive scale. And they were under Leo X, which prompted Martin Luther into his protest. And we go from there. So Leo X was a very, very pivotal pope, and in not good ways, really, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, where people had problems with the Catholic Church for hundreds of years, you know, going back to Jan Hus or John Wycliffe, or all sorts of people had had issues. But it all was tipped over the edge by Leo X. Anyway, I'll talk about that next time. But in terms of art and Michelangelo, Leo wanted him to build quite a few things, sort of insisted he do quite a lot for him. One of the first things was the facade of San Lorenzo in Florence, another church, to design and really help build or sculpt the whole facade of this giant church. Never ended up happening exactly. And Michelangelo was kind of actually scared of the heirs of Pope Julius II. Like there was the Duke of Urbino, was one of the main heirs of Pope Julius II. And he was an extremely serious man. And so Michelangelo was fairly rightly scared and sort of tried to hide in all sorts of ways, tried to get the Pope to protect him or maybe pay some of the debt. So it was a headache in all sorts of ways for Michelangelo. Then there's a whole period of Michelangelo's life where the Pope and some other people sort of insist that he starts sourcing his marble from somewhere else. There's the famous quarry at Carrara where the best marble came from, absolutely best marble. And it had been a quarry since ancient times. There was another quarry that they'd found fairly recently at a place called Serravezza, which is in Tuscany, much closer to Florence. But Michelangelo knew sort of straight away that it would just take lots and lots of time and energy and money to source the marble from this new place. They'd have to build roads from scratch and put all the infrastructure in place from scratch. And Michelangelo was right. They spent a few years sort of kind of, in a sense, wasted a few years sourcing marble from this new quarry. But you know, what the Pope wants, he gets. If he says something or sort of insists on something, You've kind of got to do it, really. So the next big project that Michelangelo is set to by the new Pope, Leo X, is another tomb, another big set of sculptures for a tomb, this time for the Medici family. Now, Michelangelo has had a bit of a strange relationship, on and off relationship with the Medici family to do with the Republic. And I'll talk all about this next time when I talk specifically about the history of the Medici family. Michelangelo was sort of loved them, but had all sorts of issues and problems with them politically. But Leo is the Pope now, so he's sort of obliged or has to do really what he's asked. So the Pope puts the Duke of Urbino off, pays him a bit of money and puts a bit of pressure on the Duke of Urbino so that Michelangelo is released from the pressures of working on the late Pope Julius II's tomb, so he can work on a Medici tomb. And it's a joint tomb. It's for Giuliano and Lorenzo Medici. That's Lorenzo the Magnificent, who had taken Michelangelo under his wing, and his brother, the one that was murdered in church by the Pazzi family, Giuliano Medici. And it's this room, I've been in it, it's a remarkable space. There's also plaster casts of them in the Victoria and Albert Museum. If you can't get to Italy, but you're in London, you can see, you know, sort of perfect plaster casts of them in there. And it's this room, an odd, really odd space, an amazing space, but there's sort of these big doors, which are fake doors, they don't lead anywhere. And there's four big niches in the wall, which apparently Michelangelo originally planned to fill with statues that personified great rivers, but he never finished those, so they sort of stand empty. And then there's these two big statues of the brothers on opposite walls facing each other. And Lorenzo the Magnificent is sort of very deep in thought. And they're stylized figures. People think that they don't necessarily represent what Giuliano and Lorenzo actually look like. They're sort of very stylized. But Lorenzo's very, very deep in thought. Very obviously sort of supposed to represent the contemplative life. And Giuliano is looks much more like a military man, sort of chin up, chest out. Looks a bit, the clothes he's wearing looks a bit like a Roman emperor or a Roman general, supposed to represent sort of action. And at their feet are personifications of, well, for Giuliano at his feet, two statues, one that's supposed to be twilight and one that's supposed to be dawn. And for Giuliano, it's day and night. And those statues themselves are very good. The female ones do suffer a bit from that thing I said before, where Michelangelo makes his women very muscular. So you see, I'll put pictures up. But those statues that are at the feet of Giuliano and Lorenzo are considered absolutely fantastic works of art in and of themselves. Again, there's that mastery of capturing a sort of a specific pose, sort of quite a difficult pose, when the body is sort of contorted in quite an odd way. And to pull that off to make it look very, very realistic is very hard. And the look on their faces, you know, to get such a strong impression of their emotion, and you've rendered that in stone or marble, it's remarkable stuff. And one of the few passages I'll read today from Vasari talks about. Vasari says, he wanted to execute the work in imitation of the old sacristy made by Filippo Brunelleschi, but with different decorative features, and so he did the ornamentation in a composite order, in a style more varied and more original than any other master, ancient or modern, has ever been able to achieve. For the beautiful cornices, capitals, bases, doors, tabernacles and tombs were extremely novel, and in them he departed a great deal from the kind of architecture regulated by proportion, order and rule which other artists did according to common usage and following Vitruvius and the works of antiquity, but from which Michelangelo wanted to break away. The license he allowed himself has served as a great encouragement to others to follow his example, and subsequently we have seen the creation of new kinds of fantastic ornamentation containing more of the grotesque than of the rule of reason. Thus, all artists are under a great and permanent obligation to Michelangelo, seeing that he broke the bonds and chains that had previously confined them to the creation of traditional forms. So a lot of the things in that that joint tomb of the Medici, a lot of the things that Michelangelo chose to depict, again, the statues that are at the feet of the tomb of Medici, hadn't really been done before. There's such sort of extraordinary expressions and poses. There's one where, is it Knight? He's sort of looking over his own shoulder, and sort of most of his face is, he's got his back to you, and most of his face is largely hidden to the viewer, and he's sort of looking, it's an odd expression. I'm not sure I've seen it before or since. Remarkable. That's the sort of thing that sets you apart as a genius, you know, if it's done well, if it's done brilliantly, which of course it was. The next thing that came up, and I will only touch on this because I'll save all the details for next time when I talk about the tribulations, the highs and lows of the Medici family. But throughout Italy in the middle and late 1520s, there were all sorts of wars. I mean, Italy had on and off wars all the time throughout the Renaissance and the Middle Ages. But at this point, particularly, the Spanish invade, and with a lot of German armies, German mercenaries, filled with the fervour of Luther. There are Protestants. And at one point, Rome itself is sacked. What is it, in 1527, if I recall rightly. Rome itself, these Spanish and German armies enter Rome, and there's a giant massacre. And lots of things are destroyed. And it's really terrible. Rome has been sacked loads of times since the ancient world. Loads and loads and loads of times. Like a dozen times or more. But it hadn't been sacked in a long time. Not really since the rebirth of classicism had happened. Not since Rome and the Catholic Church had sort of refound its feet and gone through a re-golden age had it been sacked. So this is a really, really terrible moment. For Catholics in the Middle Ages, there was sort of the time before that happened and the time after it, sort of a pivotal sea change thing. Yeah, thousands and thousands of people were killed in the street, men, women and children and things, because the armies, the Spanish armies and the Protestant German mercenaries, they saw Rome as that it become anti-Christian, that the Pope was an antichrist, that the current Catholic Church was terribly wrong in all sorts of ways. But I'll go into that in more detail next time. And anyway, the Medicis were even expelled from Florence at around that time. By this time, Leo had died, and then there was another pope, which no one talks about all that much, and Adrian, and he didn't last very long. And then the next pope, Clement VII, is Giulio de' Medici. So another Medici. And again, Michelangelo was raised with him. He was raised with both those two popes. I mean, not quite. He didn't enter the house of Lorenzo the Magnificent until he was 12 or 13 or 14. But still, for quite a few years there, he sort of, you know, shared their house, ate with them, was raised alongside them. So he knew them very, very well. And they knew him very, very well. Anyway, this time is very tumultuous. This is when Rome is sacked and things. And the Medicis are even expelled from Florence. And during that time, Michelangelo is asked to create fortifications. So I said before, and said in the Leonardo da Vinci one, that if you're a great artist, if you're a great sculptor, you're probably also going to be asked to do architecture and just designs of all types. Just anything that requires sort of drawing and design and imagination, even in the broadest sense. You would expect it to be employed in all that sort of thing. So anyway, there's a point in time in the late 1520s where Florence asks their great master, their great artistic master, Michelangelo, to do drawings and designs for the fortifications of Florence. They knew that the papal armies, now again under Clement VII, Medici, would come and retake Florence. And Florence always really wanted to be a republic. There's just this endless struggle, really, between Florence wanting to be a republic and being dominated by the Medici family. And this is just the latest iteration of that, where the Pope Julius VII is coming. He's going to retake Rome. He's got the papal armies are sort of fairly huge and sort of almost certainly not going to be able to be resisted. But Florence wants to try. And so they asked Michelangelo to do designs for all the fortifications. There's a specific hill, the hill of San Miniato, near Florence, because Florence sits in sort of a bowl-shaped, saucer-shaped valley. The River Arno runs through it, and there's particular hilltops around that you would need to defend, build a bastion or a castle or a fort or some sort of fortifications at these specific points. Otherwise, Florence is just open. Key strategic points. And anyway, a lot of Michelangelo's drawings survive for these designs, for these forts, these bastions. And they're quite remarkable. They're, again, a bit like Leonardo, completely ahead of their time. And I obviously put some of them up so people can see. And they had quite a few of them built. But the long and short of that is that the papal armies were sort of too big and powerful. And despite Florence and Michelangelo's attempt to keep them out or just defend Florence, that was unsuccessful. And Michelangelo, when this happens, when the papal armies under a Medici come back to Florence, you know, you can make the argument it's their rightful place. If Pope Clement VII rules anywhere other than in the hearts of men, it would be Florence. But Michelangelo knows that he's done a lot of work to sort of keep him out. And so he fears for his life. And Vasari gives us, I won't read it, but Vasari gives us a whole long description of how Michelangelo fled the city and exactly where he went and by what route he got out. But it became clear after Clement VII and the papal stroke Medici armies re-enter Florence, it becomes clear just through intermediaries, through agents, that Clement VII bears Michelangelo no ill will whatsoever. So Michelangelo's gone for a while, a year or two, but eventually gets homesick and comes back to Florence. There's a period there where he hid in various people's homes, and different dukes in central and southern Italy offered him sanctuary, offered him money and sanctuary. Because everyone, like Leonardo, he was very, very famous in his own lifetime. And lots of rich and famous men wanted him to come and work for them. So Michelangelo never really wanted for new patrons, people that would take him under his wing. There was always that. And so when things are sort of patched up between the Pope and Michelangelo, before long, the Pope says, look, okay, we're cool. I'm going to need you to come to Rome and start building all sorts of things for me, or designing them, or painting them. Just like all the other popes, he thought that he would largely be immortalized if Michelangelo did work for him, did paintings for him and sculptures for him. So Vasari said, it became necessary for Michelangelo to go to Rome to serve Pope Clement, who, although still angry with him, as a friend of talented men, forgave him everything. And once again, it crops up, it just keeps cropping up intermittently in Michelangelo's life, that the heirs of Pope Julius II, particularly the Duke of Urbino, started putting more pressure on him again. Michelangelo sort of resurfaced after this period of actual war and strife, and then going missing, and then making it up with the Pope, and then coming back to Rome. Suddenly Michelangelo's sort of back on the scene, and the heirs of Julius II start putting him under incredible pressure. But we're told, eventually agreement was reached. Again, the Pope sort of used his influence and power to sort of calm him down, calm the Duke of Urbino down, who was apparently a very, very fiery individual, wouldn't take no for an answer, a martial ruler, someone you just don't mess with. Again, a bit like a gangster, really. But the Pope was able to calm him down and give him some money again and all that sort of thing. And he set, this time now, the Pope set Michelangelo to go back in the Sistine Chapel. You know, it took him years and years to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. What was it, 4 years, 4 or 5 years to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. He now has to go back in there for another 7 or 8 years to paint the far wall, the back wall, the west wall of the Sistine Chapel, the Cappella Sistina, which is it's the Pope's private chapel. So it's sort of the inner sanctum of Christianity in a way. When the Pope gets up in the morning and has his prayers, does his praying, it's there. So it's supposed to be sort of one of the most holy of holy places. And the Pope wants, everyone adored the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And there was the back wall there, and so which had already been painted on. But the Pope wants Michelangelo to do something new on it. So he does, Vasari tells us. But at that very time, the Pope took it into his head to have him near him in person, to have Michelangelo near him, as he wanted to have painted the walls of the Sistine Chapel where Michelangelo had painted the ceiling for Julius II, who was nephew of Sixtus. On the principal wall behind the altar, Clement wanted him to paint the Last Judgment, and he was determined that it should be a masterpiece. On the opposite wall, over the main door, he had commanded that Michelangelo should depict a scene showing Lucifer driven from heaven as a punishment for his pride and hurled with all the angels who had sinned with him into the depths of hell. So as I mentioned, this project takes something in the order of 7 years, 7 or 8 years. Michelangelo does other projects as well at the same time. Even though he's getting on now, he's sort of into his 50s. And even 60s by this point, he actually, even though he's a workaholic his whole life, that's one of the things you can say about Michelangelo, he worked very, very hard. If anything, he does sort of up his productivity, sort of incredibly. The other thing I think to mention at this point is that despite a long and torturous back and forth, he never returns to Florence in his whole life. He very nearly does a few times, and the Florentines want him back. There's a Duke Cosimo, and Vasari himself want him back, and he threatens to loads and nearly does. But for the last 30 years of Michelangelo's life, he never actually does return to Florence. But before that, sort of just before that, he's ordered to, or he's commissioned, to work on a library, a Medici library, where he'd made the tombs of the Medici above it in the same building. There's sort of this really grand staircase. Everyone thinks it's sort of one of the greatest staircases ever designed and built. And it was only really designed by Michelangelo, never actually really built by his hands, crafted by his hands, just designed by him. And which leads to a library. The Medici had, only the richest of richest people would have a library. Books were extremely expensive and rare. So to have such a collection of them that you would need a library is absolutely remarkable. But of course the Medici had to have one. And Michelangelo designed it. And again, it's an incredible space. Having a library be a bit like having a giant hangar full of classic cars like Jay Leno. Only the super rich could dream of such a thing. Eventually, Clement VII himself dies of natural causes, and he's succeeded by a Paul III. And this Paul III was just a massive fanboy of Michelangelo. Everyone was, really, but particularly this Paul. Because let's say, as I mentioned a moment ago, Michelangelo's old now, so Paul III had sort of grown up where, in a world where Michelangelo had sort of always been a very, very famous artist, the greatest artist almost alive. Leonardo's dead by this point. So once again, for this Pope, Paul III, it's a no-brainer. I insist, I have to have Michelangelo working for me. In fact, this is a line he's supposed to have said. Pope Paul III said, I have nursed this ambition for 30 years, i.e. being Pope and having Michelangelo working for me. I've nursed it for 30 years, and now that I am Pope, I will have it satisfied. I shall tear the contract up, i.e. the contract that Michelangelo had with Julius II and his heirs to finish that tomb, which is preventing him from doing other work. The Pope Paul III said he will tear that up. I'm determined to have you in my service no matter what. A big part of being a medieval pope, or perhaps popes at all times, but particularly medieval ones, is they just sort of insist on things. They just want things and they sort of complain and moan and bully until they get their way. And they nearly always do. And so it's not long before this point. Let's draw the story of the tomb of Pope Julius II to a close here, because it drags on for longer. But eventually what happens is the Pope says to... the Duke of Urbino, the badass one that might actually injure or kill Michelangelo, he's died, and there's the next heir for them. And he's a much more reasonable person. He knows it's been a ridiculous headache for Michelangelo for well over 30 years, close to 40 years. Lots and lots of money has changed hands. And he realises that you can't just intimidate Michelangelo into finishing work. You can't really do it. It doesn't work like that. You can't intimidate someone into creating a great novel. They won't be in the right mindset. You can't intimidate someone into doing a great painting, right? You can't stand over their shoulder with a knife to their neck saying, you know, now conjure the muses and create something beautiful. It wouldn't work. It doesn't work like that. You need to give them some leeway, some laxity, some... He needs to be in the right mind space. And so to be coerced into it under sort of threats of violence, basically, is not a good idea. So the next heirs of Julius II, they strike a deal, basically, with Michelangelo and the Pope. They say, look, we've paid you loads of money over the years and you haven't produced, but we'll sort of let that slide. We'll give you a bit more money to finish it. And these great designs, so if you remember, when the Julius II himself and Michelangelo first sat down to design what they wanted to do, it was this grand giant thing, this giant freestanding building of a tomb with 40 plus statues on it. The heirs of Julius II say, look, okay, we'll reduce the designs even more. We'll make it that we'll just have this Moses on the front of it and a few others, a handful of others, and it won't be this massive freestanding building, and it won't be in St. Peter's. It'll be this much more smaller project. But let's just, for the sake of everyone, let's just get it finished. Let's get an agreement in place. And Michelangelo and the Pope agrees to this. Michelangelo, you spend a year or two finishing it and everyone can put this thing behind us. And that's basically what happens. So that project had gone on for, as I say, about 40 odd years, but finally, eventually it gets finished. And it is, you've got to say, as great as it is and as great as that Neptune is, Moses. As great as that is, it's a shadow of what it was supposed to be. But there you go, it would be extremely difficult to finish such a giant project when Michelangelo is so sought after. And Michelangelo was nowhere near as bad as Leonardo da Vinci for not finishing things, but he wasn't too far off. So many things where the original concept, the original idea was so much bigger and grander and marvellous than the thing that you finally get. I mean, out of the great, great statues, sculptures he did, I think there's only something like 11 or 12 that were sort of perfectly, brilliantly finished, you know, to that higher polish, that higher finish, like the Pieta in St. Peter's. There's a lot of other ones he did, a lot of other statues he did, which just are still sort of fairly rough, only sort of half blocked out, Vasari calls it. Now, let's talk all about the Last Judgment. Again, considered one of the greatest frescoes, it was a fresco again, of all time. And it's a giant piece, it's like one whole wall, I'll put pictures up so everyone can see, one whole end wall of the Cappella Sistina is the Last Judgment. So it's one giant piece. And it shows, as it says on the tin, the Last Judgment, the end days, Armageddon, rapture, the moment when the world ends, and Christ, the Christ comes down again, and the kingdom of heaven comes to earth, and all the sinners are cast down into hell, and the chosen, the elect, ascend up to heaven with Christ. And there's loads of figures on it. I think hundreds of figures on it. And it's just this giant thing that you could keep looking at for ages and ages if you wanted to.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.